Thanks, Cynthia. And hello, everybody, and thank you for packing the room for our session. I was asked to provide an update from the CTP perspective. I have no disclosures, and what I'm about to say also does not represent any kind of official FDA policy. I'm just, to the degree that I can, providing an update. Okay. So what's the context in which to best understand this still? Is this better? What's the context in which to best understand what is still a relatively new law and a new set of responsibilities, as has been laid out by the prior speakers? And so just like Cook's tour of an evolution of the tobacco marketplace over the years, we went from basically just the cigarette industry to cigarette companies putting cigarette brand names first on more conventional smokeless tobacco products and then dissolvable tobacco products. We've already talked a lot about the explosive growth of the e-cigarette category. We got gels, we have rubs for nicotine. And then when you throw in basically everything else, from hookah to more conventional smokeless products, cigars and pipes, the marketplace is rapidly evolving. The point I want to make is, but what's the one thing that is unchanged? What is the one thing that really it all comes back to and that FDA finds itself squarely in the middle of? Well, with all these other changes, with cigarette companies being in the smokeless business, the dissolvable business, the e-cigarette business, having wholly owned pharmaceutical subsidiaries, what's the one thing that hasn't changed? It's the nicotine. It's still ultimately about the nicotine in these products. And that's one of both the great opportunities and challenges for FDA as we interpret and apply this new set of authorities. And as you heard earlier, this brand new standard by which we're going to be regulating tobacco products. The definition of a tobacco product basically comes down to, is it made or derived from tobacco? And even if it were, is it making a claim that would put it into another category, whether a drug or a device? So as long as it's made or derived from tobacco and is not making a claim, That's the regulatory pathway for FDA to regulate tobacco products. And the law recognizes the agency as the primary authority for everything from manufacturing and marketing to distribution. So what products are regulated? The initial grant of authority under the law was just for cigarette tobacco, roll-your-own tobacco, and smokeless. But everyone's heard this odd legal word, deeming, because they're... there was a provision in the law that said, but the agency can exercise its authority and deem other products that meet the definition of a tobacco product to be within its regulatory reach. And that's what everybody is waiting to see with the so-called deeming proposal. In order to do that, the agency has to go through a rulemaking, and it is now a matter of public record that we have submitted the deeming proposed rule to OMB, and it is currently under review at OMB. Slide's a little hard to see, but the point is, with all of the tried and true policy interventions and actions that constitute what we would all call comprehensive tobacco control, we can now add regulation to the mix or give regulation a seat at the table, along with prevention and treatment, surveillance, education, price, clean indoor air, and finally regulation. You've already heard this point about we're not doing it under the traditional standard of safety and efficacy. This is my second tour at FDA. And when I was at the agency the first time under Commissioner David Kessler, we did try to regulate tobacco products under the safety and efficacy standard. We did a 2.5-year investigation into the role of nicotine in the design and manufacture of cigarettes and smokeless tobacco products and asserted jurisdiction and published both a proposed and a final rule, ultimately to see the whole thing shut down by the Supreme Court in 2000. And during the 9 years that it took Congress to put FDA back in the business of regulating tobacco products, the legislative branch thought long and hard about what the standard should be. They could have restored the authority under safety and efficacy, but chose to do something that makes a lot more common sense given the product or products that we're talking about. And it's a standard generally about public health. But the key point here is it is about the net population-level health impacts. And the law specifies what the mandatory individual and population-level behavioral considerations are that we have to grapple with. And it basically comes down to impact on initiation, impact on cessation, and impact on reinitiation. And it's going to be our job as regulators to figure out at a population level what is the net impact of what we would say from a public health standpoint is either a good population-level impact or an adverse one, and what is the net of all that. Some milestones in the life of the statute and the center. Prior to my arrival, the ban on flavored cigarettes with, of course, the congressionally mandated exception for menthol, youth access restrictions, ban on descriptors, warnings on smokeless. We all know the story of what happened with the warnings on cigarette packs. And the first ever massive longitudinal survey. And the PATH study is now in the field, and this is going to be a 60,000 person, adult and youth, longitudinal study that's going to answer lots of questions about behavior and also will include the collection of biospecimens. More recently, the establishment of the list of harmful and potentially harmful constituents, guidance on something we haven't spent much time talking about yet, modified risk tobacco products. And then on my watch as center director, I became center director first week of March, we made the first decisions. This is now in late June, for new products, but under this thing called substantial equivalence, whether certain new products could or could not come to market under the substantial equivalence pathway. And since June, we have been making decisions, either saying, yes, these products are substantially equivalent and can come to market, but just as significantly, if not historically, for the first time, using regulatory authority to say to sponsors who wanted to bring a product not currently on the market to the market under this pathway, no, you can't, because you haven't met the statutory standard. As you heard from Joelle, in late July, we published the advance notice of proposed rulemaking on menthol and released the preliminary scientific evaluation. And just as the fiscal year closed a little over a month ago, I'll have more to say about this in a second, we awarded grants to 14 tobacco centers for regulatory science. Here are our ongoing priorities. They fall into three buckets: research, public education, and enforcement. And a couple of years ago, our Office of Science published a long list of research priorities, and we've tried to synthesize it, and we've kind of narrowed it down to these seven major areas. The threshold of dependence for nicotine and issues related to reducing nicotine in tobacco products, analyzing any product out there, whether we currently regulate it or not, we certainly have the power to commission research to better understand the products. What is the impact of the characteristics of any tobacco product on initiation? What are the toxic thresholds? What's the impact of potential modified risk tobacco products? How are consumers perceiving any and all of the above? And what are the most effective communication strategies? And we were very excited to announce these new tobacco centers of regulatory science. The first set of awards for 14 centers, $53 million, and this is going to be a five-year commitment up to $273 million in the areas that are listed there. We are also getting very close to launching our public education campaign. Those of you who are familiar with my past know that I was at Legacy for 2 years and ran the Truth Campaign for 2 years. And so I know what it takes. If the target is a very, very difficult to reach target, at risk, vulnerable, sensation-seeking 12 to 17-year-olds, what does it take to break through? Why does the government think it should even be in the position of investing money to break through to kids, to address issues like addiction and health consequences? Well, we're doing it because we know that when it's done well and with enough of a dose, that it can have an impact. And so we're going to start with the launch of a general market campaign sometime in the first quarter of next year, and we are on track to do that. And as 2014 moves forward, we will have separate but related campaigns for subgroups that are particularly vulnerable: rural youth, minority youth, LGBT youth, and we just recently awarded a contract for Alaskan Native American youth. And the third ongoing priority is enforcement. And we've invested a lot of money in restarting the program that we did the first time around in the late 90s with enforcement contracts with states and localities to enforce the youth access restrictions in the law. To date, we've done north of 200,000 compliance checks, issued over 10,000 warning letters to retailers, and are in the phase of civil money penalties for retailers that are repeat violators. I want to close by talking about the future and what I see as two important opportunities and the kinds of challenges that come with them. One is product standards, and the other is what I've called the need for a comprehensive nicotine regulatory policy. Those of us that worked all those years on behalf of getting this legislation passed to put FDA back in the business of regulating tobacco products, did the best that we could to make sure that the tools at the agency's disposal are tools that will make a difference from a public health perspective. And somewhat subjectively, I'll just say that, in my opinion, of all the tools that we have, the one that possibly is the one that can make the greatest positive impact on public health is the power to issue product standards. And this is the power to either ban a substance, ingredient, or compound, or restrict it. Congress said that we cannot ban entire categories of products. States actually are free to do that. FDA is not. But we do have this product standard authority. And on my watch, I've been saying publicly for about 5 months now that we see an extraordinary opportunity here and that we are exploring potential product standards in three areas: addiction, toxicity, and appeal. I can't say anything more than that because this remains deliberative internal discussions, but we are looking at this and we're investing in research that could support potential product standards. My closing point is on nicotine, and some of this may sound as provocative and unsettling to some of you, especially in the manner in which Cynthia teed up the e-cigarette discussion. But we have to be honest with ourselves and acknowledge that there is a continuum of nicotine-delivering products out there, products currently within FDA's jurisdiction and after the deeming regulation goes into effect, with FDA occupying and regulating even more of that spectrum of nicotine-delivering products. And the inescapable reality is that it's cigarettes that cause the overwhelming majority of the disease and premature death. And a number of you have heard me invoke the late researcher Michael Russell from the UK, who wrote almost 40 years ago, "People smoke for the nicotine, but they die from the tar." So I'm not saying that nicotine is a completely benign or safe compound, but it's not the nicotine that's killing half of all long-term cigarette smokers. It's what creates and sustains the addiction. It's not what kills them. And so we have to be honest with ourselves and acknowledge that this spectrum exists. And this public health standard that we are responsible for now at the agency, and this notion that it's about the net population level health impacts, also should give us pause, and we should look in the mirror and ask ourselves some hard questions about subpopulations. One of the subpopulations is that group of smokers who, for whatever reason, they're either unable or unwilling to quit. Are we going to condemn them to several more decades of cigarette smoking and the inevitable disease and premature death that many of them will experience? Or, if it's really not the nicotine, what more can we be doing for them using regulatory policy? As you heard in the e-cigarette presentation, this is fraught with risk. And at this point, we have far more questions than answers. Any initiation of any nicotine-containing product is bad for public health. But at the same time that we're asking questions about the adverse effects from initiation, let's not forget currently addicted smokers who are otherwise unable or unwilling to quit. I think that this is an enormous regulatory opportunity for FDA that spans centers. This is not just an opportunity for the Center for Tobacco Products under the public health standard, because if this is ultimately about nicotine policy, then this is also questions that our Centers for Drugs and Devices need to be asking themselves. And prior to my arrival, those three centers, tobacco, drugs, and devices, were holding a series of meetings to at least sort out an important foundational issue, which is answering jurisdictional questions of which center would regulate which product in which scenario, depending upon which claim. But it really wasn't the policy exploration. So that foundational jurisdictional analysis has been done, and now we're figuring out what form that should take in terms of sharing it with the public. But I have begun to challenge colleagues throughout the agency internally. Okay, now let's have the policy discussion. With everything that we don't know about this new generation of products, but with e-cigarette users certainly voting with their pocketbooks to the point where one of the analysts predicted in early 2013 that e-cigarettes would surpass NRT sales by the end of 2013, and most people said not possible. And it turned out that she was wrong. It's not only going to surpass NRT sales this year, it's going to almost double NRT sales by the end of 2013. So something is going on out there. Consumers are demonstrating that they're open to getting their nicotine in newer and different forms. And I think the challenge to all of us is to maintain an open mind, ask all the right questions, have all the right doubts, all the right hesitation, given the history of the category that we're talking about and the interests behind it. But there is an opportunity here to revisit nicotine policy that could do a lot to help those currently addicted smokers. And as I said, fraught with risks and lots of questions, very few answers at this point, and a clear potential for unintended consequences at a population level. I concede that. But we need to have an open mind and have that discussion and have that debate and then figure out what role regulatory policy can play, what role communications can play, what the research needs are, how quickly we can get the answers to the questions, and see if we can come to some kind of new understanding when it comes to nicotine policy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mitch. I appreciate your whole presentation, but particularly sort of that framing at the end, because I don't disagree. I don't think my position's unclear to anybody. But again, there are layers, especially with respect to the e-cigarettes and regulations, whether they should be used in indoor environments, what about sales and marketing to minors, and then there is this big question about cessation device and then regulating it. So at least it can be in that category of an FDA-approved smoking cessation device. So thank you for those comments, and many thanks to Joelle and Valerie for setting us up and giving us the background on menthol. At this point, opening up questions to the audience. Go quick, because I'll try to go and order pebbles.
Yes. And we'll go to thanks for those presentations. Mitch, I want to know how the addressing disparities fit to the population that impacts, because most of the population that carries disparities are small populations. So like, for example, in Hawaii, 78% of Native Hawaiians smoke menthol, just like African Americans. But then you find most of so how does this net population impact kind of work with the whole disparity culture that we face here?
Did everybody hear the question?
No.
Pebble's question is, if you're talking about health disparities and certain minority groups, how are we as regulators to factor that into an interpretation and an application of the public health standard? It's a great question. And the point that I tried to make was it's about net overall population level health impacts. I don't want to, and I can't sort of prejudge any kind of policy that we have yet to make here. So I guess I'll put it back on all of you. We do not have a monopoly on the interpretation of that standard, and I've tried to lay out that this is far removed from a more conventional standard of safety and efficacy. It's really about behavioral impacts. I mean, we're going to look at product harms, but this public health standard is fundamentally a population level behavior standard, and I have reduced in public discussions. Reduce that to really two questions: who and how. Who is using any of the products that we're asking questions about, and how? So if you think that there is a particularly vulnerable at-risk subpopulation that may not contribute substantially to the denominator, but you believe that the adverse effects on them are still significant, then you should ask yourself, as you interpret the public health standard, knowing that this is ultimately the net at a population level, how should the regulators fit in a particular problem with a particular subpopulation? We haven't done it yet. When it comes to regulatory policy, we have said, as regards menthol, that with the information that is in on initiation, that was sufficient for us to be able to commit that when we launch this public education campaign next year, there is going to be specific messaging on menthol. But that's not a product standard. That's not, you know, other more forward-looking restrictions on the behavior of a regulated company. I can't be more specific than that because we just haven't gotten far enough into it so that we can sort of show the world how we're doing it. But it's a very fair question to which we welcome any and all suggestions for how we should be interpreting it, so that we can factor it in, even if a particular population is when it comes to the numbers in the minority. And I can't do any better than that.
Thank you all for a great session. Mitch, I have another question. So I think one crucial issue with e-cigarettes is where they fit on the continuum of risk. There was one slide that said they're 20% as dangerous as regular cigarettes. There's another report, I think, from an e-cigarette industry that said it's two orders of magnitude, you know, 1% or something like that. So certainty would be good here, and I know there's a gazillion products and certainty would be difficult with so many products, but I have to think between the FDA and CDC's labs and funded research that we might get a better handle on that. Can you give us any perspective on what kind of work is being done there, and might we get a better sense of really how relatively clean or dirty these things are?
Yeah, I don't know I don't know how long it would take to be able to make the relative comparison, but sooner rather than later, there's going to be a much better understanding of what makes these products tick. Some of the TCORs grants that have funded will be looking at electronic cigarettes. There are literally dozens of studies in the field already trying to get a better handle on the toxicity profile of these products. And we have a contract relationship with the CDC laboratory and our own Southeast Regional Laboratory in Atlanta, where we're analyzing all manner of products. But I don't know how long it will take to take the fruits of all of that analysis and be able to say it's X times less harmful than some other category or some other product. And we may have to leave it to the field to make a determination like that. But we owe it to everybody to, and it, this doesn't have to await the deeming regulation, as I said. We are and will continue to commission the research to answer these questions, even if we're not yet in a position to regulate the products, because I've called it the Wild Wild West. It is the Wild Wild West because there's no regulation and the companies remain free to do anything that they want.
Just a real quick follow-up. Can you demand information from the companies?
Not until they're subject to our regulation. Gary's question was, can we demand information from the companies? And the answer is no, not until we can for cigarettes, smokeless, and roll your own. But until the deeming regulation is final and in effect, we could make requests, but they're not subject to our jurisdiction, and so we can't compel anything.
Thank you. Okay. Question up front. Thanks, Naftali. To respond with, I believe you did. And we have one more question in the back, and that'll be the last. Mitch?
Well, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how do you like the show? I respect where you're coming from, and while this is legislation that passed with a lot of bipartisan support, I know that there were very thoughtful people in the tobacco control and public health community who, if they didn't oppose it, they at least were skeptical that it would make a difference. And I understand and I respect that point of view. I've been Senate Director for 8 months. And I was on the outside looking in for the first 3+ years after enactment of the legislation. And saw many of the same things that you're describing in terms of pace. And I took this job because I thought that I could make a difference working with some extraordinarily talented people to start to make policy, to start to churn out the decisions. You can agree with us, you can disagree with us. You could take your best shot at us through rulemaking, and we hope you do, because that's the point of rulemaking. But at least we would get some decisions out. And on substantial equivalence, on menthol with the ANPRM, and now close to being able to get the deeming proposed rule out, at least the pace has changed in the last 6, 7, 8 months. Why haven't we acted on menthol? Why haven't we banned menthol? We issued an advance notice of proposed rulemaking and asked a series of probing, provocative questions about what the regulatory status of menthol should be. We're still in the middle of a comment period. It wasn't extended for 90 days, but it was extended for 60 days. And that comment period is going to close in a few weeks. We asked those questions very, very seriously, because we have reviewed and continue to review all of the information in the published literature and from other sources on the impact of menthol in cigarettes. And we ask those questions because we are genuinely interested in getting supporting information in response to those questions. And we will take our review of those submissions very, very seriously. I absolutely hear the frustration in your voice about the pace, and everybody is entitled to their opinion about the merits of the legislation, how things have been going back to June 2009, as it's now basically 4.5 years since the law was passed. I'm biased, I suppose, but I see that that if we do this right, we have an opportunity to use the tools of regulation to make a positive difference on public health at the population level. I wouldn't have returned to government after a 13-year hiatus if I didn't believe that. And not because I think that I'm going to make the difference, but because there are some really wonderful people in this center, in the various offices, that come to work every day thinking that whether it's science or regulation or policy or communications, just the people that come to work for and do management, that collectively we all think that we can make a difference in uncharted territory. There is no regulatory agency anywhere in the world that has this set of authorities and the rather vast financial resources at our disposal to implement them. But I think that we will make a positive difference. It's why I came back to government, but I absolutely respect the view of those who continue to have doubt this far in, given how long it has taken FDA to accomplish certain tasks.
Thank you, Mitch. Please join me in thanking our panel. I'm very sorry. It is noon.